I've had a lot of coffee, and this one stands out. It's called Larry's Coffee. It has this really cute vibe to it, first of all. I've been drinking it in the mornings, and it's noticeably smoother. My favorite blend is Bean Martin. It just tasted so good. I immediately went and got a second cup of coffee. I just love the rich, dark flavor. It's got a little cartoon character on the bag, and he is drinking coffee, and he also has a martini because it's probably an espresso martini because, you know, he's Bean Martin. They have light, medium, dark roast, espresso, decaf. Larry's Coffee is independent, family-owned and operated, roasted in Raleigh, North Carolina for over 30 years. You can try this wonderful coffee and support the BGS Podcast Network at larryscoffee.com/BGS. Listeners of the BGS Podcast Network get a free gift with purchase when they purchase through that show link. And again, that's larryscoffee.com/BGS. Thanks for listening to the BGS Podcast Network. If you're interested in diving deeper into the world of roots music, Americana, and beyond, be sure to explore more from The Bluegrass Situation. Visit thebluegrasssituation.com to browse the latest editorials. And don't forget to subscribe to our weekly newsletter for new releases, exclusive content, video sessions, and more delivered straight to your inbox. Sign up at thebluegrasssituation.com/newsletter.
What would it rob you of if someone told you it was going to be okay and gave you that guarantee before you decided to do the things you wanted to do? And I was like, well, it would rob me of my learning, of my resilience, my self-belief, my abilities. So yeah, nobody told me it was going to be okay.
We often define artists by their output, their records, books, movies, and the times they're on stage.
But the art is made in the quiet, the struggle, and the mundane. The hours that no one sees. I'm Michaela Ann.
And I'm Aaron Schaefer Hayes. This is The Other 22 Hours, an exploration of the creative life lived in the in-between. Hey, welcome to today's episode. It is episode number 150, and so we decided we've done this enough that we might as well approach this one as a giant experiment and do something we've never done, which is have ourselves as guests for the first time. So we're doing our intro live rather than doing it at the end. So all I can say is this will be an adventure that we're all on together.
Yeah. So we have just released, and I'm saying we because Aaron and I made my new record together. These Are the Days, which came out on May 8th. And so with 150 episodes, as well as putting out a record together and all the things we talk about on this podcast, we thought, what if we interviewed each other about being a married couple, making a record together, working together, doing a million things together?
Mm-hmm. As we like to focus these conversations on our guest and our shared relationship with creativity, it's come to our attention that maybe we don't share a lot about ourselves. So in the tradition of our intros for this show, today's conversation features Michaela Ann, who is a singer-songwriter and a songwriting coach. Michaela has released, this is her fifth record, sixth, if you count the first one, fresh out of jazz school. And it is the first record in over a decade that she owns entirely. The past four records have been released on indie labels, all of whom now own those masters. And Michaela has toured with the likes of the Wood Brothers and Watch House and Bonnie Light Horseman all over the States, all over Europe, and has been a featured guest instructor at songwriting camps at Sisters Folk Festival and at Folks Fest for Planet Bluegrass in Colorado. And in addition to that, has been my partner in all things for 19 years.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah.
And our other guest today is Aaron Schaefer Hayes.
This is so awkward.
Aaron Schaefer Hayes, who is an acclaimed producer and multi-instrumentalist. When I met Aaron, he was a barefoot pandero playing dude on the jazz school floors. If you don't know what a pandero is, it's a Brazilian tambourine that Aaron is remarkably good at, but hasn't played for a really long time. I have gotten to watch Aaron evolve into a drummer who has played with so many artists and bands on tour, like Nicole Atkins, Elizabeth Cook, the Watson Twins, Aaron Lee Tajdjian, J.D. McPherson, Margot Price, and I have watched him evolve past that and become a multi-instrumentalist, teach himself how to record and compose, and decided I want to do sync for TV. And now his music has been placed on major network television shows like Station 19, like The Good Doctor. What was the most recent one that just came out?
Best Medicine.
Best Medicine. And become an emotionally intelligent and sensitive creative director and producer of many beautiful artists.
Man, now I see why we do these after the fact.
I know. Do you feel emotional? I feel emotional.
No, I just feel awkward. Well, as we like to start off, how are you and where are you, both physically and creatively?
I am feeling good today, but also like very sensitive and raw for some reason. I was just, before I came out here, was just talking to our nanny about pets dying and was crying. So I feel a little open, but also because I played a show last night in Nashville with some of my oldest friends and it felt great. Physically, I'm here in Nashville at our studio, and creatively, I feel really open as well. My creative path feels very like seasonal, and a lot. Sometimes I go through periods of time where I'm just like not buzzing and not porous, as Maggie Smith calls it. And right now I feel very buzzing and porous and open.
Nice.
And what about you?
Physically, we're in our studio in the backyard, as we always are, which gives me a little bit of like a Pavlovian response because I just come out here to do all of my creative work. So that helps me arrive in that. How am I? I'm doing well. I'm exhausted, as you are, with two little kids and spinning 10 plates at once all the time. Creatively, I'm feeling inspired but detached, if that makes sense. I feel like I have a pretty full tank creatively and a deep well, but like it's elusive in that if I actively try to dip into the well, I can't like see it or feel it. But if I just turn off that active part of my brain and just let my creativity flow, I have plenty of fuel and plenty of inspiration and action there, which is a weird feeling to be inspired but not be able to like actively engage it, really. Yeah. I guess what I'm saying, to be less obscure, I guess, would be if I focus on the work that I need to do and just trust that my inspiration is there, it is there and it spurs. I'm juggling a bunch of projects at the moment in a bunch of different directions and approaches. So that makes me a little bit creatively numb, even though they're different enough that I don't expend my creativity.
Yeah, I observe your creativity because of the work you do as like a faucet that you have to turn on and off all the time. You're like, oh, I have to do this sync song. I'm going to turn it on and come up with an inspired guitar part, and then I'm going to turn it off. And now I'm going to switch over to this artist's record that I'm mixing and get into that space, which feels, I feel like a little more willy-nilly in what I do creatively. Mm-hmm. Of like, I get to do it. If I don't want to, I don't have to, where I feel like you have to.
Yeah. I don't know if that's necessarily good or bad. I see that. And to me, I view your creativity and the way you're able to approach it as like creativity more in its purest sense, where mine feels like a little like utilitarian creativity, like service industry, which I think is like from how I've come up.
Mm-hmm.
Even when I was a kid, like never was I really just creating to create. I'd write like songs here or there, you know, and I'd play like the drums for fun. The largest part of me growing up, like I just wanted to play the drums.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't want to be like a front person at all. The exact opposite. I was like, put me at the back of the stage.
Yeah. I know. That's so interesting. I feel like I've gone through periods of time where I feel pressured to write because of career stuff, of like, I got to make a new record because time is running out and people are going to forget about me. I mean, granted, I just put a record out, so there's like a little bit of cushion, but I feel very in like a playful space, but also probably because I've just written like 7 songs that I'm sitting on that I wasn't expecting to, all inspired by my schoolwork of grad school of studying depth psychology of creativity. But it's just fascinating to think of all these different ways to utilize our creativity, where it's just like, oh, I want to play with my imagination right now. Or, okay, I need to utilize my imagination to get work done. They're both play, but sometimes it's like framework or not.
Yeah, it's the context.
Mm-hmm.
I hear you say like, I just want to like play in my imagination for a while. And my initial response is like, oh, that sounds fun, which I've definitely gone through like phases of doing that. I just feel like the current era of our lives or my life is just is not.
Yeah.
There's no time for that. It's very much like task based at the moment.
And then also our imaginations are utilized every single day and night with our child who is endlessly asking for stories. And we're like,
Yeah.
What can I make up right now?
My 47th variation of a story of a girl riding a unicorn into outer space.
Yeah, I mean,
which is beautiful.
We've moved past the 100 variations of the Three Little Pigs.
We found all of them.
We made up.
It did help me to think of that as like creative endurance training.
Yes. Yeah, when you're tired and you're like, okay, I have to think of new characters within the framework of the Three Little Pigs, new interesting houses, new interesting Big Bad Wolf. I mean,
I had to like distill myself down to like understanding the macro points of a story.
Yeah.
Like, okay, development, characters, mm-hmm. conflict, mm-hmm. resolution. Okay. I feel like there's multiple times that we walk into the room, the other person's in the middle of a story and our eyes just say like, help. Yeah. And I feel like our daughter's getting to the point that she looks at us and is like, where's this going? What are we talking about?
Yep. Okay, I have a clipboard.
This is the first time we've had notes on this show.
Yeah, so we want to keep this conversation centered on the themes of this podcast, the other 22 hours, mm-hmm. but also focused on the main project of making my new record.
Yeah, which is like an evolution of how our creative relationship started.
Yeah.
In that, as I mentioned in the intro, like we've been partners for 19 years, mm-hmm. met in college, but not long after I started playing in your band. You didn't mm-hmm. really have a band when we started dating.
I hadn't even played a show.
I think Justin Matthews were playing shows.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I had a guitar guy.
Yeah. You had a guitar guy.
Yeah.
But as soon as you started having a band, I was kind of playing drums with you.
Mm-hmm.
And very early on, I think we were very intentional about establishing like, this is separate from our relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you are hiring me. I'm playing in your band. It's your band. It's your thing. Separate from our relationship. Because both can be messy. So not to have them interact with each other.
Yeah. And over the last 19 years, we've gone in and out of playing together, refusing to play together, very far reaches, doing our own thing separate from each other,
mm-hmm.
coming back together. But I'm curious, in the past few years working on this podcast, and then you've produced my last two records, the first one, Oh To Be That Free, we co-produced because that also felt important for me just in my, I had made so many records with dude producers that I felt like I was a producer on and just wasn't credited for. So that partnership, being able to do that with you, it felt important to be like, this is together. And then this time around with These Are The Days, I think also we had a child. Our partnership felt so much more stable than it's ever been. That credit didn't feel important anymore. And also, I think I was like, the personal life, professional life all bleeds together at this point. So it's like, hey, I need you to handle even more on my record because I'm going to be handling our child type thing. So you produced this record, but I'm curious, inspired by one of our previous guests, Major Jackson, what kind of personal work do you think you had to do to be able to get to the place to work with your wife, me, creatively?
This is like big picture.
Yeah.
We started working together so early. It wasn't like I had to make a decision to work with you creatively.
But how do you think you had to personally evolve or do things to be in a place to work successfully with me, to be able to like handle conflict and tension without us exploding at each other and to really like get the best out of our working relationship and the work?
My initial response is like, have we figured that out yet?
Yeah. Acceptance, knowing that there will be times of tension.
For sure. And decoupling our personal relationship from the work and focusing on the work. Honestly, the hardest thing is that's different for me working with you than with any other artist is removing myself from it.
Mm-hmm.
Working with any other artist, it's really easy to remove myself from it. And I take pride in that because I've never been a front person, because I've never had my own thing. It's never been about me. I don't find that I have anything to prove in somebody else's music.
Mm-hmm.
I view my job as bringing their music to life in the light that they see it as best as possible, which I judge I'm able to do for you. But it's so close to me that I have to like very actively be like, is this decision for me or is this decision for Michaela, and turn myself off. Or I notice that most when I feel like pushback. That's when I really have to check it. I'm like, is this pushback because I'm really close and this creative choice or direction doesn't feel like me? And so that's like the alarm bell going off. Or is the alarm bell going off because it's not serving the song?
Mm-hmm.
The truest point, having to like check that.
Yeah. I feel like one of the things we've navigated is we came up with very different musical influences. And
for sure.
One of the places that we have tension is when naming things more genre-based, when I want to pull things more country and traditional, and this is my interpretation, and you are like, hey, let's try something different. And then the difference is the fact that we're married and have a personal relationship in history. It's so much more loaded than if I was just working with another producer and we pick up on each other's tone, and then like there's 20 years of like...
Yeah, you
so
say
like,
one
you
sentence
don't want
in here,
me
20.
To do. Like,
you hate this. It's like, I don't. I don't hate country music. I just hate safe choices.
Yeah. And I'm like, but sometimes a safe choice is just...
The right choice.
The right choice. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's an example on my end of when I have to be like, is this just like my own preference?
Yeah.
Or will the song be better if we push a little bit?
Yeah.
You know, because... Safe can be totally fine, obviously, mm-hmm. and it serves the song, and sometimes anything more than that just gets in the way.
Yeah, and I think for both of us coming from jazz school and then in New York City, where the culture was so, everything had to be new and interesting. And then also like the culture of me working at Nonesuch Records, which you were by proxy, like because we lived together, you like also experienced that. It was really about just like always trying to push the envelope. What was celebrated was like the most kind of inventive, which was a struggle for me because I felt like my heart was more in kind of traditional stuff, but that seemed boring to the people around me in mm-hmm. my interpretation. And then moving to Nashville, which felt like the opposite spectrum. A lot of just folk songs, country songs, very traditional, not pushing the envelope.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of finding the line of like, well, what do you want to make? What do I want to make? What do we want to make together?
Yeah, I think in my reaction to that is like, I don't know if it matters what I want to make.
In my record.
On your records
yeah.
or any records. Obviously, my taste and my instinct comes into it, but like, it doesn't really matter what I want to make. They're your songs and your vision, and you're ostensibly hiring me to make your vision.
Yeah, I like
come to
hearing
life.
That.
I mean, I don't see how it could be anything but that.
But not every producer feels that way.
They should make their own records then.
Yeah. I mean, I told a friend one time that every producer I've worked with, I was like, you're the producer. I'm paying you money to produce this. But like, also I want this established. Any arguments or disagreements at the end of the day, I always win because it's my name. I'm paying. It's my songs.
Mm-hmm.
And my friend who's an artist was like, oh my God, I could never say that. I would be so terrified. And I'm like, that's just how I want to roll. And I guess not everybody does, but I like, that's how I feel.
Hey, just a quick pause from this conversation. The Other 22 Hours is an independent production built entirely on the idea that these quiet, honest conversations matter. The best way to support our work is simply to share it. So if you can think of one person who would appreciate this show, please pass it along. And if you haven't yet, please follow our show on your listening platform of choice or subscribe to our channel on YouTube. It's a small action that makes a massive difference for us. Thanks for being here. Let's get back to our conversation. So how does that apply to us working together? Do you feel more empowered to say something, or do you feel more empathetic, more sensitive to my response?
In making this record and now, I feel more empowered to say things and feel very confident in you knowing my taste musically and prioritizing that and putting that as your first main decision. And also you not getting defensive or personalizing it when I don't like something that you like or are wanting to do, and you being able to pivot. I think that's been a major growth in our working relationship and creative relationship.
Mm-hmm. For sure. I see that too.
And specifically this record, These Are the Days, what was the most challenging part of making it? Whether it was like in regards to me or the record in general? And on the flip side, I also want to know the easiest part.
The first thing that comes to mind is the timeline. The timeline, I think, has been the hardest. You know, this record just came out when this conversation comes out. Mm-hmm. But we recorded it at the end of January 2024. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of life that happened in between there. Mm-hmm. Between, it took a year to get it mastered after we mixed it on the production end, you know, mm-hmm. producing this record. That was the hardest. I think in like a tangible task was the gap between mixing and mastering. I had to spend some time to sit with the record before hearing Raylan's masters. I went back, I listened to the rough mixes. I went back and listened to like early bounces from like tracking just so I could like realign my head with our initial intent. Mm-hmm. And it's like, what record were we making in April of 2024 when we mixed this? Mm-hmm. Not what record are we mastering in April of 2025?
Yeah.
You know, because aesthetics change. We changed. We had a whole other kid.
Yeah.
There was no talk of another kid when we made the record. And by all the time we were mastering, we had another kid.
Yeah.
Full living, breathing human being. So as like a task and like a tangible thing in producing this record, that was probably the hardest externally. Keeping the continuity of intent over that time. How about you?
The actual making the recording of the record that week that we spent, probably the most challenging thing for me was mentally and physically juggling Georgia, having a toddler, just making sure we had childcare lined up. It's a different thing for me to now be like recording, writing, and always my brain is always running math and other needs simultaneously of like, okay, we're recording, but now I got to go at 2:30 to go pick up Georgia or make sure the babysitter's there. But like, even if the babysitter's taking care of it, I'm still mentally like, are they cool? Does she have her? Where are they? Does she have her snack? All mm-hmm. of those things are still running in my mind constantly versus before that recording, like how we made O to Be That Free was so leisurely. I was pregnant, so I was tired, but it was just like we had no schedule. That was probably the most challenging. And then also the business side of things, which is the reason that the timeline was so stretched out mm-hmm. of I was still technically under contract potentially with my record deal when we made the record and was trying to really just freely create and make this record, but had no idea if I wanted it to come out with that deal, if we were going to shop around for other deals. That was what was hard for me to get around. And I remember when we first listened, when I came in here and we listened to the record down before we sent it off for mixing. And I was so happy, but then I also started crying because I was like, I'm never going to get to play these songs live because I think my relationship with my booking agent had just dissolved mm-hmm. after a year or two of BS that sucked. And my headspace around my career was really bad. And I mm-hmm. was like, I don't have any opportunity. I lost everything. All the people who were supporting me in the past think I'm done. And so it was hard for me to celebrate this music without being like, but what's next? And there's mm-hmm. no hope for what's next. And thankfully, I feel very different now. And so in some ways, it's been like a good lesson and like the timelines are what they're meant to be.
Yeah. I mean, the public narrative behind O to Be That Free was that you wrote and recorded these songs. And then in that time, became a mother. Your mom had a stroke. There was all this change. But to me, like this record is really the amount of life change that has happened in the full span of this record mm-hmm. for you. I mean, for us, but specifically for you as the artist and the creator here, like, is insane, mm-hmm. for lack of a better word. You started writing these songs from a place of like, I haven't written in 2 years. I'm a new mom. This tragic thing happened to my mom. Like, am I going to write again? Do I have a career? What's happening? And then I noticed and have heard you talk about how like writing these songs, I started to like, you're like, oh, I can do this. I'm in there. And it kind of built your confidence up and all of that. And then we made the record and you still had a very reputable booking agent. You had a record deal, like all that. You're like, cool, I'm doing this. I'm gonna put out a record, and like, blah, blah, blah. Recording, making a first record as a mom now into really what I view stepping into your power and your ownership. Mm-hmm. And like you said, the relationship with your booking agent that you've talked on here before, which in my judgment and my own words was negligent at best, if abusive at worst. Mm-hmm. You basically called him out and are like, are you doing something or not? Shit or get off the pot kind of thing. To which you parted ways, mm-hmm. which I'm all in support of. I think that was a powerful move. Mm-hmm. And then ostensibly you did the same thing with your record deal. Mm-hmm. You're like, surprise, here's a record. It's mixed. It's done. And they're like, we love it. Great. And you're like, cool. I want to own my masters, which they came around to. And they said, cool, we'll do a licensing deal with horrible terms. To which mm-hmm. you're like, I'm good. And they let you walk away.
Yeah.
That's another like powerful flex. So you stepped from putting the infrastructure of a team in front to like stepping back into ownership mm-hmm. and being the boss and all of that into now being in this spot where you've created your whole team and really you're fully steering the campaign, everything about it. And now you're a mom twice over
yeah.
with all of that and in grad school and expanding and all of that. That's a massive shift of self. Does it feel like that long of a book to you in terms of self-identity?
Mm-hmm.
If you can pull up who you were when you wrote the first song for this record, which I don't even know what was the first song you wrote.
I think it might have been If Your Body Fails You. I know I started that song on that Europe tour.
With Georgia.
When Georgia was just about to turn two. I started it backstage in the green room at the show in Oxford. But I think the difference is I spent so long really depending on outside forces or people or booking agencies or indie labels, the things that like our scene and industry celebrates as my affirmation of like, see, look, the cool agency, I'm with them. So clearly I'm good enough. Like mm-hmm. this indie label, I'm with them. So clearly I'm. And then what comes with that is like the team of support and like the camaraderie of other people on the roster and the ins at the festivals and like you're in. And losing all of that, but like choosing to lose it because I could have just stayed in those situations by not saying anything and just accepting what was offered, but I pushed back, was not done in this like, I deserve better and I'm so confident and I'm going to go out on my own. It was done continually in this like second guessing, low self-confidence, but just so much discomfort. It wasn't like an uphill battle of self-empowerment. Like I feel mm-hmm. like I now feel really good, but I've spent so much time like feeling rejected and wallowing in that. And I look at life before and after like this record or like motherhood. And I used to feel very much like that's me back there and what happened to her. And I now feel like through the last few years, I'm like, oh, that was me. And now this is me. And liking this version better. So it does feel like a really long book. Mm-hmm. It feels like it's taken me a long time to get here.
Have you gotten here alongside this record or because of this record?
Ooh, that's a really good question. Did you just think of that?
Improvising. I got a jazz degree.
Maybe both, because I do think this record has been such a vehicle.
It is a vehicle, yeah.
For change, like the songs as well as putting the record out, of like how to put it out. Choosing to do a Kickstarter, which in the past I had such a challenge with a Kickstarter that I felt like it looked like I was drowning or something, and shifting that perspective of it actually being a really empowering thing. Getting to like pick the people I want to work with, aligning with the people that I feel like really understand and support, and also the people I want to support by paying them. Yeah, I think alongside and through it. The writing of the songs. I used to think co-writing was kind of like a crutch in a way. And this whole record is co-written because I just couldn't write without my friends who wrote these songs with me. And now I see so much power and strength in collaboration rather than, no, I do it all by myself.
I love that. I'm listening to you say that. I'm thinking about like, I'm pretty sure it's either therapy work I did on my own or therapy work that we've done together. But like any healthy relationship is like a growth seesaw.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like there's a little input here and then it's like, oh, wow, there's inspiration that flows on the other side. And then that surpasses and it keeps climbing up like that. And it sounds like that's been your relationship with this record. There was times where making this record was pulling you along and forcing mm-hmm. growth on your end. And then other times where your growth and input and conscious decision making and actions then pulled this record along, and it's kind of started to turn into a positive feedback loop.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound accurate?
Yeah. And especially, I just want to say that so much of that was possible because you were not just cheerleading me along. You were like very kindly and lovingly and supportively also saying, get your shit together. like at some point you got to stop crying about what happened in the past and get with the picture of like, this is what life is, whether we've chose certain aspects of it or not. And we can make the best of it, or we can be stuck in the past. There's like a narrative that got stuck in my head of, oh, things were better back then. And you will like tangibly walk me through all of the ways that life was not better back then and the ways that life is better now.
That can be like a slippery slope, mm-hmm. a feedback loop in the opposite direction, where if you're so focused on how it was then, inevitably the good back then starts to become gooder and the bad now becomes even more magnified. And I saw that happening. And so I was just trying to like stick a stick in the spokes and be like, whoa, slow down here. I mean, I've said to you a thousand times, but to share with like everybody else, it's like downstairs in our playroom, there's all of these posters on the wall. I think all but one of them is from, let's say, post-pandemic, when your words, when your career ended. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting there like in that room playing with our kids, hearing you talk about how your career is over, even though you just got back from tour. And I'm looking at posters for like Hardly Strictly Bluegrass Festival, Bonnaroo, Kayabo, Mountain Stage, Folks Fest. I think there's a couple I'm even forgetting, all of which happened after this date. Mm-hmm. And so it was out of like love and compassion that it's like, this all happened since then. It's something that I do like, not out of being a know-it-all, but from having like lived that experience and like missing out on the present and what's here and what actually is better, because I've seen every crack in the road along the way.
Well, and I think what I continually am learning is that sometimes our creative work, when it's within an industry or a scene or a community, can become this currency or this way that we're looking at it to be a way for us to feel affirmed in life, to be validated. And what I've been seeing is that no outside validation is going to be enough to make me feel included or a part of things or legit or whatever, if I don't feel it inside. Like that proof of all the festivals I've booked or all the tours I've been on still didn't make me feel like others were telling me, yeah, you're in with us. You are a valid musician in our community. Even though we take you on tour, you're on these festival billings with your actual heroes. I think some of those festivals, my name is literally under Emmylou Harris. And because of just the fixation, also the power I gave one person who told me I wasn't worthy enough at that point, and that destroyed everything. So I think this journey has also taught me that, of just how dangerous it is to put power in anybody's hands, even when they have tangible power of like getting you access. It doesn't matter. Like, you can't give them the emotional power over you.
No, don't put anybody on a pedestal, even yourself. In this specific case with his booking agent, yes, everybody knows who he is. Every venue knows who he is. He has booked shows at every single venue, but he wasn't for you. He wasn't booking tours that we were coming home rich, even on the when things were great.
Yeah.
Bunny ears for those not watching. Well, like, he wasn't good at his job.
For me. Know? Yeah.
For you. The big things that he gets for big artists are like, I could send an email on behalf of that artist and book them all those shows because it's the artist and not him.
But I think the lesson also to be shared is that we can put too much focus on the names of like, oh, these are the agencies you want to be a part of. And like this lesser known boutique agency is like, it's too folksy or it's not legit enough or so it doesn't look cool or you feel a little embarrassed. And I've learned all that matters is the relationship you have with the person, because if the person understands who you are as an artist and cares about you and your life, that is more powerful than the top name at the best known agency who has access to everything. Because if they don't care about you, or they don't know you or care to know you or care about your family or you as a person, it's more damaging.
For sure.
It's not going to help your career to sacrifice that. So I've learned over and over again, work with the people that you feel safe with, that you don't feel nervous to tell them, I can't do this because my family life is a priority, or I don't want to do this, or you don't even feel comfortable to speak up in certain ways about like, well, actually, I want to do this. That's, I think, for the public and especially for any artist of any age, the shiny things are not the best things.
No. Yesterday, I was interviewed by a student at MTSU, Middle Tennessee State University. He's a freshman, his major's audio engineering, production, all of that. I don't know if he listens to our show or not, but he asked me, like, what do you wish you knew when you started on this as a career? I'm like, we asked that question too. It's a good question. And even though we ask that every week, it's not one that I think of much. And what came out, I think applies here. I was like, I think the faster that you can learn the difference between assumption and intuition, and the sharper you can make your radar for that, the better. Because assumptions are going to lead you astray. You can assume that, like, because this person has a big name, they can get me all of these things. And you can assume, like, because I only know two people on this person's roster, they can't get me anything and it's a bad look. That's an assumption. And you're automatically, like, boxing yourself in. Whereas, like, if you listen to your intuition, it's like, my gut says this is not a good direction to go. My gut says this is a good direction to go. It's a hard thing to differentiate. I think I'm still working on that. You know, it's like, is my gut talking or is my gut, like, wrapped in a candy coated layer of my ego being like, no, this is the right choice?
Yeah, because also your gut sometimes isn't activated when you're blinded by wanting to succeed and wanting to feel worthy, and someone's coming along that you think has the power to do that for you, and you're not personally in a place yet to understand the difference.
Yeah.
So I think about, like, the stories of Dolly Parton, you know, where she wouldn't sell I Will Always Love You to Elvis because they were going to own the publishing. And she was like, no. And she did not know what was going to happen in her life. She had a feeling, but she was just like, no, I'm not giving away my publishing. And what, 20 some years later plus was when Always Love You became a massive hit. I grew up thinking, like, or whatever time I heard that story, I'm going to be like that. I'm going to have the self-knowledge and strength and belief to be like Dolly Parton. And I have learned I have not. And that's okay, because we have the lessons that we're supposed to learn in this life. But I do think it's even more exciting when you realize you choose yourself and your story's not yet finished, but you choose yourself even when it's been scary or hard, and start to see the way that life is growing in the way you hoped it would. Where with this record, right before we started recording These Are the Days, I said, and I've probably told this on here, I've definitely written about it on my Substack, but I said to a million different people, but namely my therapist and my mom, I said, if someone could just tell me everything's going to be okay, I would get out of my record deal, self-release this record on my own record label. I would go to grad school and I would have a second baby. And my mom said, it's going to be okay. And every one of those things has happened. Do I have millions of dollars and, like, out of this world success like Dolly Parton? Not yet. But if this is as good as it gets, it's pretty fucking great.
I agree.
That was a big realization I had the other day. Of, we kind of operate in the music world of thinking, like, oh, this next record is going to be the one. It's going to change my life. Or people talk about, like, oh, that song changed my life. And you ask me every day now that I'm in album campaign mode, what are you hoping for with this record? Why are you doing this? What are you doing this for? And I'm like, oh, I'm not hoping for a life change. Like, I love my life. I love our life. We're doing all the things we've dreamed of doing. We're planning our growth and move to New England, building a bigger studio. We're owning all of our work. We're working together. We're building my coaching business. We have our family. Like, all of my dreams are this. Do I have millions of dollars and am I famous? No, but maybe that actually wasn't a vital part of the dream.
That's a powerful realization.
Yeah.
I know that your mom literally said everything's going to be okay.
Yeah.
But your mom and I both know that, like, we can tell you things 1,000 times and it just flies through the net. So did anybody tell you everything's going to be okay? Or did you make all of these decisions and pivots regardless of that?
My therapist said, what would it rob you of if someone told you it was going to be okay and gave you that guarantee before you decided to do the things you wanted to do? And I was like, well, it would rob me of my learning, of my resilience, my self-belief, my abilities. So yeah, nobody told me it was going to be okay. My mom said, where there's a will, there's a way. If you want to do it, you can figure it out. And the confidence of our partnership, you saying, even with grad school, you were like, are you sure you want to add this to your plate? And also, I've taken it off my plate for this quarter. Like, maneuvering constantly of like, these are the big things we want to do. When do we want to do them? They don't have to all happen at the same time. So yeah, nobody told me it was going to be okay other than you being like, I'm willing to try with you because I can't do anything without you fully on board because we are life partners and we have two children.
So many logistics.
So many logistics.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, in my head the whole time you're talking, I'm like, is anything ever okay? And does it matter if it's okay or not?
Yeah.
If you have a roof over your head and you can put food on your plate,
you're okay.
Given the state of the world, maybe that's like the bare bones that we need to focus on.
Yeah.
But really, every high point in my life, if I kind of flip through in my head what I today deem as my highlight reel, which is probably different than what my highlight reel was yesterday, and it's going to be different, you know. But for like at any given point, if I look at my highlight reel, like it wasn't flawless. There's some highlights that like come to my head where like my personal life was a dumpster fire with like just an open gas leak into it. You know what I mean? And vice versa. There's been times in my life where me as a human being have been at my high point. My career has been nothing. And sometimes those are like connected. And I feel like most like a human because I care least about my career.
Yeah. I mean, I think about when my mom was in a coma and we didn't know what she was going to come out like. And my dad just kept saying, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. Mm-hmm. And I would get angry because I'm like, you don't know if it's going to be okay. But in hindsight, was it okay? It was what it was.
Exactly.
It wasn't okay to me what's happened to my mom or so many different things that have happened in the last 5 years or giving birth without my mom there. But we survived. And there's also like really, really beautiful stuff that happened amongst the not okay things.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, the like, is it going to be okay is such a interesting question that I probably won't ask anymore.
I agree. I don't think it needs to be asked.
Yeah.
Everything, at least in my experience and in my reading and thinking and talking and asking, like everything in this world craves stasis, whether it's like our physical bodies or the ecosystem, whatever. Everything is constantly trying to land in balance, whether we wanted to or not. Everything lands in balance. So like everything is going to be okay. Is it going to be fun or easy or quick to get there? Like, no.
Mm-hmm.
Where we are now in our careers, in our personal life, in our family life, like all of that, like the last 6 years have been fucking rough.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if I would do it differently.
Mm-hmm.
I think we are who we are and we're doing what we're doing and we have the viewpoint that we have because of everything that happened. I know that's like super cliche, but like...
No, I agree. Like my gut
imagine
response,
if the last 6 years were squeaky clean, like smooth.
I know. And I think about how different my art feels. I think about, you know, my mom is such a wise sage. Obviously, like I would have loved to not have her suffer in the way that she has, but she's even pointed out the beauty or the gold in her not being available through us becoming parents. It could be argued that it really solidified our partnership and our co-parenting and the way that we did not really lean on anybody but each other outside. I don't want to say like discount. We had immense support from our community and your parents, as well as my family, to the best that they could. But like both children being born, it was us.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody was in this house with us.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and just like the way that we've grown and the trust that we've built and the way that we've gotten to know ourselves and our community and what we want. And think about the way I've gotten to know my parents differently through this time. There's so much that I wouldn't want to be different in some things. And I think to bring it back to this record, These Are the Days, in really focusing on, you always say like a record is a record of a time, way more than it is a career move or a time of critical acclaim or a time of economic growth or whatever, like financial growth. It's a record of a time in life. And this record really represents this time in our life in such a beautiful, whole way. I'm curious, in now sharing it with the world, what are you most excited about in that sharing? And also, what are some of your favorite memories of the actual making of the record?
Favorite memories of making the whole record is just like the crew of people that were in here for the basic tracking.
Yeah, it was so fun.
And the whole approach. I mean, so we had five of us, including you, here for the basic tracking. Myself on drums.
Owen Biddle
on bass. John McNally on electric guitar and pedal steel. And Seth Taylor on acoustic guitar. If you're watching, I'm pointing to where they physically were sitting in the room here.
And mandolin and...
all things acoustically strung. And that was just such a fun crew to carve these songs out with and create. But then instead of doing overdubs like one person at a time, we did everything with multiple people in the room. So when we brought Ethan Ballinger in on lead guitar and Jimmy Matt Rowland on all things keyboards, they were here at the same time to add that layer together.
That was also a uniquely fun experience.
Both wonderful, unique people in their own right, and you put the two of them together.
Insanely talented and also very interesting minds.
Yeah. And then we did two sets of background vocal sessions. One was Lyle Davinsky and Kishana, which was really fun having them sing together and work together. And then we had, for the majority of the record, Oliver Bates Craven and Lauren Belthrop singing together, which are two of my favorite voices.
Them together was incredible.
Not only having like all that energy in the room, but getting to carve these parts out together as a group. Mm-hmm. And then it was really special that when we got to vocals, we spent 3 or 4 days on your lead vocal, didn't rush anything. And it was just you and I. Mm-hmm. I felt that was really intimate and nice. And then I feel like Georgia was here all day for everything. I know she like went
she
to
wasn't.
School, but I feel like she was just here hanging out, twisting
knots.
She was
here for like, some of the end of the backing vocals, I remember, because I was in the vocal booth with her. And one of her biggest things that she misses right now about having a baby brother is that when we would do podcast interviews or recording, she would come in and get to have a big snack tray. And the vocal booth would be a big cozy corner with like lambskins and blankies and
salt rock lamp.
Salt rock. And she'd get to watch her TV shows with her headphones. And now that we have Henry, we can't do that.
There's always a babysitter here now.
So she's like, I want to come in the vocal booth. But yeah, so her presence was here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How about you? What was the favorite memory of like the making of the record? It's funny that like you had said, I always drag out making a record. Mm-hmm. I want to make this quickly in a condensed period, which
we did
until we very much didn't.
Yeah.
Which that was out of our control. That was like more on the business end.
Yeah.
But so in the condensed time of making this record, which was 4 weeks, maybe.
I think it was just like being with the musicians. It was so fun to be creative in that way and hear the different parts. It was also the first time I had an acoustic player on a record that was like just designated.
And man, if you pick an acoustic player, holy shit.
And Seth Taylor is out of this world, currently in Post Malone's band.
And on every record that you hear.
Yeah, he's just incredible. And also just like everybody's energy. Everybody's playing was great, but everyone's personality and energy was just so open and loving. So that was probably some of my favorite times. And hearing these songs come to life and Ethan's guitar parts. Like I remember on If Your Body Fails You, having like an emotional release like we both did afterwards and hearing his guitar part on that. Those are probably some of my favorite. Oh, and my favorite, which thankfully I have on video, is when we brought Georgia in to listen to That's What I Tell Georgia. Mm-hmm. And she heard, I'm going to cry again. She heard her name in the song and got so excited. That was probably my favorite part.
Yeah, I remember she's in here in her PJs. Mm-hmm. And it was like the winter, so it was already dark. And it was like nice warm light in here.
Yeah. She heard you say daddy. Oh, no, she heard me sing.
I didn't say anything.
Sing. Daddy listens down the hall and she was like, oh, you.
Yeah.
And then her name. Those things feel so special regardless of anything else that happens with this music.
Yeah. As you know, we like to be very conscious of our guests' time.
And our listeners.
Yeah. So those of you that have listened to the show before know that we end with the same question. But because we're doing this all differently, this is a big experiment right now. Normally our question is something along the lines of, what do you wish you knew when you got started in this career? But since we're flipping the whole script on this, I'm interested in knowing if you could tell yourself a year from now something, what would you tell yourself a year from now? What do you hope you know a year from now? Because this episode is airing after the record is out. You can go listen to it right now. Shameless plug. But we're recording this a month before it actually is released.
So a year from now, what do I hope I know?
Yeah.
It's going to be okay. I'm going to cry.
We've had tears of sadness, tears of joy, tears of fear.
In that, I think like the thing that you are constantly trying to remind me of when my go-to is stress and anxiety is just enjoy it all. Just enjoy it all. I hope a year from now, I am able to enjoy all of it. Like enjoy the stress of putting out a record, packing up a house, moving, finding a new property and building the thing that we've been talking about since we were like 21 years old, and just enjoy all of it. It's going to be so cheesy, but I'm going to say it. I really do think that these are the days that we're going to look back on and be like, God, that was the time in life.
I agree. I try to be conscious of that all the time.
Yeah.
And it's like joy and sadness.
Mm-hmm. What about you?
What do I hope I know a year from now?
Yeah.
For me, it's more like moving out of my head and into my heart. And I hope that I feel and know in my heart that the decisions that I'm making currently and the choices that I'm making were in full presence and consciousness and intentional and not guided by ego or fear or running away from something, mm-hmm. that I'm running towards something.
Do you feel like you are?
For sure. I just hope it stays there. I tend to, in times of hardship or struggle, instability, I think in a very human way, reach for the wall of the elevator shaft as I'm falling. Because I have a tangible grasp on something. When I grab on, I'm like, nope, this is it. This is great. And I hope I enjoy the fall, if there is one, and just be like, nope, it's all shaking out. And this is the hurricane that we set in motion. And here we go.
Yeah.
Because I don't know if what we're going to do is going to work, but.
I know. Even the like sharing, we talked about this, of like sharing it as we're in process is holding ourselves accountable without being driven by ego. I think it would be ego driven to be like, we're going to do this thing secretively and like try to still seem like we're in the mix in Nashville and not show anybody until we're like, look, we did it.
I don't think we've explicitly said that we're moving to New England in this conversation.
Oh yeah. We're moving.
We're moving to New England.
To build a compound.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Build a whole creative space in the middle of the woods.
To have retreats and community and all things not on the internet and AI, even though this conversation lives on the internet and we need the internet.
Everything, everywhere, all at once. Well, thanks for taking the time to sit down with us today.
Thank you, Aaron.
What an experiment.
Yeah, this was fun.
We'll do it again, maybe in another 100 episodes or so.
I think next year we should do a year check-in.
Deal. See you there.
Bye.
We know your time is valuable and we're grateful you chose to spend this hour with us.
If this conversation resonated with you, know that it is just one of many. We have an archive of over 140 conversations, so if you're looking for where to go to next, you can find curated playlists by topic on our YouTube channel or simply scroll back in this feed to find our conversations with Roseanne Cash, New York Times bestselling author Maggie Smith, Lucius, JD McPherson, and many others.
This show is produced by me, Aaron Schaefer-Hayes, with help from Michaela Ann. All the music you hear is written, performed, and produced by me as well.
Our show is edited and mixed by Leland Holden at Pod Punch, and we are proud members of the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network.
Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time.